Back together again, you and I chatting it up midweek Wednesday style, October 23rd, 2024, right here on Connecticut Today. I started the show with news that hundreds of millions of dollars in federal student loan debt has been wiped clean for thousands of folks in Connecticut. We talked about the numbers and whether or not that's actually fair. State House Minority Leader Vin Candelora talked about evidence that a Venezuelan gang could be connected to recent jail violence in Stamford, while Hearst Connecticut Media columnist and senior editor Dan Haar dropped by for his weekly thoughts on all things Connecticut.
Ah, yes, I'm here. Don't worry, I didn't go anywhere. Just a couple of days on the DL. I'm sorry, the IL. You can't say DL anymore, but I meant the IL. So how are you? I'll get to the Trump-Hitler things or thing or recording or what he said and what he didn't say in a couple of minutes. So stay in the stable with that one. Okay, we'll get to that. But I wanted to start with this. And I will say up front, right, just in the spirit of full disclosure, as they say in this business, want to be up front with you. I did some serious borrowing of federal student loan money to put my son through college. I don't have a single nanosecond of regret for that. I don't. Because the success that he's having now and what he's doing at a relatively young age can be directly traced back or linked back to the friends, the associates, the relationships he built at a very small Lutheran private liberal arts college in Allentown, Pennsylvania. He went to a Muhlenberg, and some people have heard of Muhlenberg, some haven't. So what the financial people like to say, the ROI, the return on investment, is almost already paid off for him. And it would have been paid off like 3 years ago when he was just like 26 or 27 if it wasn't for COVID. So I have no qualms in doing that because, listen, if I get up and walk out of this studio right now and get hit by lightning, which is probably not going to happen on a day like today, but if I got hit by lightning and, my head explodes and they come out, people in the parking lot say, oh, look at Paul, he's toasted. I wouldn't care because I gave him a little bit of a legacy, some other financial advice. And that. Now, be that as it may, what are you talking about, Paul? Be that as it may, I found this. This is on CNBC, the Consumer News and Business Channel, CNBC. Now, here's the headline. I think you may know where I'm going with this, but let me just read this to you. And maybe in fact, you, if you're in the situation like I am, maybe still paying off personal loans with no regret. We do what we do for our kids, many of us for our grandkids, because we love them. President Joe Biden has forgiven student debt for over 1 million public service workers. See how many in each state. And in the state of Connecticut, I'm just going to mouse over, as they say. For the state of Connecticut, the White House has said, never mind. The $827 million that has now been forgiven for 11,800 people who fit into a certain category in Connecticut. And that breaks down to just a skosh, under $69,900. That's a pretty good piece of change there. A lot of shekels, a couple of sacks of piasters, right? If you're a Steely Dan fan, you know where I'm coming from there. And the story reads as follows. Let me just give you a couple of graphs here. President Biden and the White House have hit a major milestone this October, the month we're in right now. They've now forgiven student debt balances for over 1 million borrowers through the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. That's according to the Department of Education. They announced this actually last week. Though the PSLF has been around since 2007, only 7,000 borrowers in total qualified and got debt forgiveness through the program prior to Mr. Biden taking office. So again, the program was around, 2007. I mean, that's back in the W days, Bush 43, right? Because Mr. Obama was elected in 2008. But just previous to the Biden years, only 7,000 people had their stuff written off. Now, the basic guidelines for PSLF require borrowers to be working in public service and make qualifying payments on their loans for 10 years before they see any of their balances discharged. Okay? So you've got to be in a certain line of work, and you cannot be a total deadbeat. You can't. But as of 2018, widespread mismanagement of that program has led to 99% of borrowers getting denied the forgiveness they were believed to have earned. Servicers, that's the secondary company. If you have a loan like I do, a parent paying it off, the servicers actually run the loans from the Fed, from our tax dollars here. All right. Servers and borrowers alike had problems identifying and keeping track of qualifying payments, as well as ensuring loan and employer eligibility, leaving most borrowers stuck with their debt. That's the way it is. Oh, I'm sorry. I tend to just, lapse into Walter Cronkite from time to time. My doctors are working on it. But there's a bigger picture in this story, and I think you know where I'm going with this. All right? We'll take a quick break here. We'll get through some stuff, check traffic and weather together. Because I have, maybe it's not one question. I've got a, maybe it's not a question, it's a bigger issue with this, but don't jump down my radio throat here. Joining us right now, a frequent guest here, State House Republican Leader Vin Candelora, to talk about the Republican response to kind of a shocking story. And Vin, good to have you on. You want to talk a little bit about, what is happening here in Fairfield County in something recent involving alleged immigrant or migrant gang activity. So fill in our listeners here.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, there has been Venezuelan gang activity beginning in 2023 entering the United States. And it's Tren de Aragua, which is now an international crime circuit with over 5,000 members. And they're very dangerous. They traffic drugs. They traffic women for sex. And they have been discovered in Stanford. They were first discovered in Chicago back in July of 2023. They've moved their way into New York, Colorado, and a whole host of other cities. The New York Post actually had written an article about a couple gang members who shot and killed somebody in a hotel in Stanford and stole their vehicle. They've been apprehended. And I guess what's alarming to me is, number one, that the Connecticut press hasn't reported on it, hasn't picked up on it. We're not hearing from anybody in our state, but we need to call attention to this because, pretty soon we don't want to see this gang spreading into Connecticut. And I think we need to start taking an active role of targeting this gang activity.
And Vin, the Post also ran a story. I don't know if you saw this one a few days ago, or you might be, referring to the same story here from some higher up in the NYPD in the New York Police Department. Yeah. Was basically saying, hey, folks, this gang is here. Don't pay attention to people who say it's nothing big. Don't pay attention to people who say, well, it was only one or two apartment buildings,
right,
not the entire
exactly
city of Aurora. Yeah, and this higher up in the NYPD said they're here and they're recruiting. I mean, that's pretty frightening, Vin. Maybe I'm the crazy one here, but I think that's frightening.
Yeah, I mean, we have changed the culture of our country with this unmitigated migrant population coming in. I mean, these people are not vetted. There's no public safety, and it's our states that end up paying the price for it. In the state of Connecticut, we are spending billions on our migrant population. It's coming annual. And, despite our fiscal guardrails, we are very quickly slipping into deficit post the COVID money running out. And we don't have a handle on our migrant population and the people that are here to do very bad things. And so it's something that we need to raise the alarm, and we need to start focusing and get a commitment from our government of how we're going to stop it.
How do you respond, Vin, to you? And I get this too sometimes. People call in here. They send me emails. Well, this is not really about law enforcement, you no good right wingers. Wink, wink. This is because you hate brown people and you're afraid they're going to be more of them than you someday. And Vin, you probably heard this. I'm sure you've gotten an email or people have talked to you at events. How do you combat that sort of thinking, which sadly is prevalent in some spots in this state and even across the country?
Well, frankly, it's the elite Democrats who are in their wealthy suburban homes, gated communities, that have that perspective. And I think it's gaslighting, and that's all it is. Those of us that live in our day-to-day communities have seen over time that being subjected to car thefts, to robberies, to, you know, the dangers on the street, to marijuana smoke, you know, and all these vehicles, we've seen the culture of Connecticut change. And so people could say whatever they want. It really is all about public safety. And I think it's part of the problem of the Democrat narrative right now is they want to try to lead with their heart and come out aggressively and say we're being racist. And in fact, all we're talking about is the fundamental principle of the social contract of why government is here, and that is to protect its citizens. And it's bad enough these open borders have put a cost on our states, but now what we're seeing is the lack of vetting. It's actually brought danger and murder into our communities, and it's something that we just shouldn't be tolerating. We can't turn a blind eye to it. And those that want to gaslight, I think they don't get anywhere anymore. People are more concerned about public safety than they are about this fictitious political story of racism.
Yeah, and Vin, just to dovetail off that, you know, some of our laws, now granted there's been a little bit of tightening over the years, but not much. Like, for example, Vin, and this isn't necessarily an immigrant issue, but when I tell people, and they know I'm in the business, and you probably get this too, because people question us because they're busy, they can't follow everything. Like, for example, Vin, when I explain to them that the penalty for stealing a car in Connecticut is connected to, I don't know what it is, Vin, the wholesale or the retail value of that car. You know, they look at me like I have four eyes and I just descended here from Mars. And they say, well, isn't car theft? I said, well, not in the great state of Connecticut. It's not. I mean, Vin, it's mind boggling.
Well, we fixed those provisions a little bit because, right, it depended on the value of the car. The more valuable, the more time you would potentially do, which makes no sense at all. You know, but what we continue to see is, I think, you know, that people realize that they are not in a safer place than they were before. And I'm concerned about the continued glossing over of issues like this. This is not the state that I grew up in. These are not the conditions that I want my kids to raise their grandchildren in. And the lack of people challenging it and thinking, you know, this is being political. We're in a dangerous spot because if people just dismiss it as Republicans and Democrats fighting, meanwhile, these gangs are coming in and they're going to change the face of the state of Connecticut. You know, what I have seen over the last decade is we are passing laws after laws dealing with sex trafficking in the state of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. School teachers are now being required to watch videos on sex trafficking. When did you ever conceive that an elementary school teacher should watch a video on sex trafficking? Because we are finding now that it is prevalent. We are one of the highest states in the country for this, and it's nothing to see here. And I think we have to start talking about these open borders and the impacts that it's had on our state. It's not just hitting Texas.
That's mind-boggling, Vin. And just to wrap up here, I want you to emphasize that again, that you said that Connecticut, bucolic, you know, soul of New England, Connecticut, is starting to see more and more sex trafficking numbers here?
Yeah, we've been dealing with this over the last decade, and we've passed some laws to try to tighten up. There's public spaces that need to now put up posters. And we're bringing awareness to the issue because, look, I mean, I guess where there's money and where there's elite wealth, we're starting to see that. I mean, you look at what's happening with P. Diddy and, you know, the Epstein Islands. That is a real thing. And unfortunately, I think, you know, New York City is a hub for this type of activity and Connecticut it spills into. And so that's why I think we're seeing this gang activity. that I'm concerned that we're ill-prepared for as a state to deal with.
Republican State House Leader Vin Candelora. Vin, good to always have you on. Take care, and we'll check down the road. Thanks, Vin.
Thank you. Take care.
I appreciate it. There you go. Right in the middle of the week on Wednesday, that means it's time to check in with Hearst Connecticut Media. Editor and columnist Dan Haar is with us. Mr. Haar, good afternoon, and how might you be today?
Doing pretty well. The weather's nice. I'm still working outdoors, as it is my want to do during the summer.
Yeah, when it gets to, like, October, almost the end of October, I just want it to get cold and stay cold. You know, these 70-degree days, Dan, I don't know. I know a lot of people like them, but once the leaves start falling, please.
I'm not with you, Paul.
Huh?
I'm not with you.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll take that as a point of disagreement.
I'll take it as one of the pleasant but risky side effects of global warming.
Okay, all right, we'll take that. Your tour of the state. Now, we talked to you last week when you were doing that with Channel 3, and I read your story about what you found in Hartford that surprised you. So now that that's in the books, as they say, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm just reporting on that, and there should, if all goes well, be a column by me on the five or seven or whatever. It's always an odd number. You notice that? The list of stories, the three things, the five things, the seven things that I learned on the trip. And one of the really big ones is that immigration is so much bigger an issue in the minds of voters, even in blue Connecticut. And I don't mean immigration in a positive way for people who favor a more profound influx of people. Fear of immigration is so much bigger an issue than we are being led to believe by reading such things as Dan Haar columns. That it's overwhelming, and if Hillary, I think we talked about this before. I started to say Hillary. If Kamala Harris loses this race, that's the reason.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you there. All right, number two on your list this week is interesting. A gentleman we've had on the program here a lot of times, Rob Sampson, never short of his opinions here. This and early voting, and your thoughts on that would be what?
Well, first of all, early voting was viewed as a success, which is a good thing. I would guess that the first day of early voting with some 56,000 people who voted, although I'm sure that number is not final. We reported that number, 56,000. Mm-hmm. I would guess that that's going to be the single biggest day of early voting. And while that was very heavy and there were some lines, put it in perspective and consider that in a presidential year, Connecticut will have 1.7 or 1.8 million people voting.
Yeah.
And so while it's good to have early voting, one must wonder, why were there any lines at all if the early voting is, you know, again, 56,000 is a good number for one day of early voting. I'm not denigrating it. You want to give people an opportunity to vote.
Sure.
But maybe there's something in the early voting that takes too long.
Yeah, and Dan, you know, in principle, I'm okay with early voting. I mean, I know we have the grand old days of Election Day, and I get it, but times have changed and people have complicated lives. The thing, though, that I find interesting that's always distressed me about early voting, if it's unreasonable, I don't think a few days of early voting is crazy, but when you have some of these states of weeks and a month out, to me, number one, and maybe this is just the way I am, if you find out something really bad about your candidate that you voted for, which in the present day really doesn't happen anymore, but, you know, look at what Trump said about, you know, allegedly said about Hitler's generals. You know, that could tip the scales for somebody who may have only voted. And number two, I don't think people realize, Dan, how much this helps campaigns if they see early voting trends, as we're starting to see nationally. That kind of helps campaigns really reallocate or sharpen their focus on whatever material and money assets that they have.
What's wrong with that? That's a good thing. You get another tool if you're the campaigns to sharpen it up. And as for the comments by people, by the candidates or the happenstances of the campaigns that may sway candidates, ordinarily, I would agree with you, but I think Donald Trump had it right when he said he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue. Donald Trump supporters don't give a damn what he does. What he has said to this point, he's already paraphrased Hitler three times back in the winter, which I reported. You know, he said that dark-skinned immigrants, he didn't say dark-skinned, he said immigrants, but he was talking about those countries, and he named those countries. They are not where white people live. He said dark-skinned immigrants are poisoning the blood of our country. That is a comment from Adolf Hitler, right? If people don't care that he quoted Hitler, why are they going to care that he said he wants generals like Hitler had? I don't think it matters what he does to the supporters of Donald Trump. I agree with you about Kamala Harris. Everything she does seems to be scrutinized to the point where, look at her, look what who, you know, and her supporters are a lot less, more shaky.
I never heard you quite howl that way, Dan. That was pretty good. And finally, point number three of this week's report, what in the heck is going on with that Prospect and Yale mess? There seems to be finger-pointing back and forth every day, lawsuits, countersuits. Explain this whole thing to my listeners.
How far back do you want me to go? The deal itself, it was a merger agreement made a couple of years ago between Yale New Haven Health System, which is, of course, the state's largest health system, although Hartford Healthcare is pretty big, and the three hospitals, Waterbury, Rockville General, and Manchester Memorial, or is it Manchester General and Rockville Memorial? And those three hospitals are owned jointly by Prospect Medical Holdings, which is a, for lack of a better word, it's a private equity group. Essentially, it's an investment group for they're operating for profit, but the hospitals are not exactly for profit. I don't understand how that works. But in any case, the deal fell through when it turned out that Prospect Medical hadn't been putting enough money into these hospitals. And for reasons that Yale claims in a lawsuit, they were lying about their operations. Prospect Medical then promptly countersued for Yale as a breach of contract. And that's where we've been for 6 months. And back and forth we go. The latest is that Senator Blumenthal and Senator Elizabeth Warren want to get private equity out of hospitals, and this just muddies. It's fine, you know. It's a fine debate to have, but it muddies the waters as far as this deal goes. And of course, the Prospect Medical owes $100 million to the state of Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Governor Lamont told us this week, and that's creating more havoc. You still with me?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. Oh, yeah, I haven't gone anywhere. Oh, yeah.
Because there's one more twist here.
Sure,
and that
sure.
is that the governor essentially is trying to say, you two guys work it out, cut a deal, and Sean Scanlon, who's the state controller, and he oversees health care, they're trying to say, hey, Yale and Prospect, cut a deal or don't cut a deal. They're trying to keep clean hands in this. The state can't have clean hands. The state is a major purchaser of health services and has a major policy imperative to maintain the health of the hospital system. It cannot walk away cleanly from this. That's what Yale has been saying correctly.
Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media, always good to check in with you. Dan, be good. Enjoy the rest of this nice, mild day, and we shall talk with you next week. Thank you, sir.
Vote early and often.
That's it. Thanks, Dan Haar, Hearst Connecticut Media.